Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. But today, NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secret privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sibel Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. And today we present another installment in our series about the emerging police state here in the United States of America. Our guest today is Shahid Buttar. He is the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, BORDC.org. Shahid, welcome to our program today.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter.
I've had the opportunity to talk with you and have met you on many occasions, and I want to thank you for the work that you do defending our Constitution and, significantly, the Bill of Rights, which is under assault from inside our nation. And we've had critical curtailments of our rights since 9/11. Shahid, tell us briefly about your background. I know you picked up a law degree here at Hastings at the in San Francisco, University of California at San Francisco. But tell us what in your own experience drew you to this important work of fighting to defend the critical freedoms that are enshrined in the Bill of Rights.
Well, thank you, Peter. You're very kind. And I would just say that I think it's the struggle to restore and defend the Bill of Rights is one we all share as Americans, and I'm very privileged to play a role in helping mobilize others, but I think ultimately it's a struggle that we all share as Americans. I was actually just down a little further south on the peninsula at Stanford when 9/11 happened. It was the beginning of my second year. And at the time, I was studying antitrust law and thinking that my life's work would be to work for the government busting corporations. And then, quite frankly, 9/11 threw all the cards up in the air. And what I thought was the particular locus of domination in our time, that being corporations, suddenly got switched for I had a fear at the time that much of what has happened since would happen. And quite frankly, as a Muslim American constitutional lawyer, quite frankly, just hard to do anything else. It feels very present. It feels very omnipresent. And while corporations are still certainly a threat to our society, I'm glad that there are millions of people organizing around them, as well as the state threats. And unfortunately, that battle remains unfought. And I think it's very important for all of us today who take pride in living in the land of the free to keep it that way.
Shahid, let's begin our conversation with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And in particular, a move that was made very quietly and behind the scenes last summer to extend the term of Robert Mueller for another 2 years. And I'm an older guy who remembers COINTELPRO and the decades that J. Edgar Hoover was in office. And as a result of the abuses of Watergate and other issues that were exposed during that era, Congress set a limit on the term of the FBI director at 10 years. Yet, like so many other lessons from the past that have been ignored in recent years, we saw that Democrats in the Senate readily agreed with a White House proposal to extend Mueller's term, and it's not clear whether politically they didn't have the muscle to put in a new director, or they just felt that continuity was more important than any kind of a change, despite the history of that post. What are your comments about Director Mueller and the quiet way that his term was extended in violation of the law that was passed, the reform law after Watergate?
It's a real travesty that his term was extended, especially without the congressional oversight that the Bureau really needs right now. You know, you were mentioning the COINTELPRO era and the Bureau's unfortunate history of violating the civil rights of peaceful Americans, particularly dissidents. And I think that the failure of Congress to provide critical oversight at a time when many of those same abuses are recurring, particularly the one that I get most incensed about, is infiltration. And in the most recent round of changes to the Attorney General's guidelines that were first issued to constrain FBI abuses and have since been watered down to increasingly permit the recurrence of those very same abuses, the latest version, which came out of the Attorney General's office in 08 and was then just revised in the FBI earlier in 2011, just months before Mueller was entrenched, you know, those guidelines permitted the undisclosed participation, is what the Bureau calls it, of Bureau agents in First Amendment protected groups. And so what that looks like is FBI agents surreptitiously participating in meetings of Quakers. And we know that kind of thing has happened all over the country, and I think that that's the kind of abuse that screams out for congressional oversight. And rather than check and balance the executive branch, rather than conduct the sort of insightful investigation that the Church Committee and the Pike Committee did to try to stop COINTELPRO, rather than consider laws that would put an end to these abuses, all Congress has done is rubber stamp every extension of FBI power that the Bureau has sought. And that happened in the Patriot Act. It happened again in every reauthorization round, including two that happened in 2011. And then it happened again when Congress rubber stamps the White House's incredibly bad idea to entrench the FBI director beyond the statutory term, not only because it sets a precedent and unwinds part of the post-Watergate reforms that were put in place, but also because it politicizes the director's position. It will be up to be filled in 2013, at precisely the time when the new president is coming into power. And that's not the whole point of keeping the director's position on a separate period. Mm-hmm. Then the presidential term was to insulate it from political pressure, and now we know that the next FBI director will be appointed likely because of a political relationship with whoever the president is then. And that's exactly what's not supposed to happen.
And Shahid, again, this was all done very quietly. There were a couple of news articles that reported that an idea had surfaced, and then boom, they just announced that Mueller had agreed to stay on for another 2 years. Now, Clint Eastwood did a very imperfect film called J. Edgar that was mostly based on Hoover's private life and the speculation about his sexual orientation. But it did make references to the way Hoover stayed in power. He kept dossiers on key political leaders, including presidents of the United States, and was not at all shy about letting a president know that if Hoover were forced out, that embarrassing or even potentially criminal information might be released. So I can only speculate. How did Robert Mueller win an extension of his term under these unusual circumstances? And should we be suspicious that he might be using the Hoover tactic to extend his term?
I wouldn't be surprised. I don't have any reason to believe that he is extending those same tactics, but the capacity of the FBI to be used for political purposes and for its powers to be politicized is unfortunately well-established. J. Edgar Hoover not only reigned over that apparatus, but demonstrated about a million ways in which those powers could be abused. And the mere fact that the director was extended beyond a statutory term in itself should raise eyebrows, period, because we have statutes for a reason. So when we start changing laws to accommodate particular officials, that's a red flag in the first place. And so, yes, we absolutely have reasons to be suspicious, not just with respect to the personnel change, but also the institutional practices that his leadership has enabled and has continued and entrenched. You referenced the secrecy with which the process happened, and it's interesting. On the one hand, it is absolutely offensive. On the other hand, in the national security arena, that is pretty much the name of the game. Just in the last few weeks, the president signed the National Defense Authorization Act, which represents a frontal assault on the Fifth Amendment right to due process and the Sixth Amendment right to trial, as well as the First Amendment right to speech and assembly, the Fourth Amendment right to be free from searches and seizures, and the Eighth Amendment right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment. There was never a single hearing on the bill. And the closest thing I've seen to national corporate media coverage of the bill were Jon Stewart's broadcasts on The Daily Show. And it just speaks to me, and reflects the very same disturbing pattern of these incredibly momentous, important laws, you know, laws that dramatically change rights that people fought wars over, world wars over in some cases, or the Cold War for that matter, each of which stood for principles that we've lost in the last 10 years, in times of relative silence and without the public debate that you would hope would come before anyone would even seriously consider changes of these magnitudes, let alone making those changes and locking them in place with these, I would dare say, illegitimate and corrupt laws.
Shahid, we'll return to some of the issues you've raised, the national security letters, the recent National Defense Authorization Act, and other issues. But I want to focus a little more on Director Mueller, because Sybil Edmonds, my co-host here, I regard as a victim of the abusive tactics and the power that was exercised beyond the law, extra-legal tactics, that were used to punish Sybil Edmonds for being a whistleblower about internal misdeeds at the agency, and also went to great lengths in colluding with then-Attorney General John Ashcroft to impose state secrets gag orders on Sybil. So, Sybil, I want to get your thoughts about Director Mueller and the way that his term was extended without any open process and without, you know, really any opposition.
Well, it's interesting because briefly you guys mentioned the Congress. And one of the issues that I didn't have a place to report to, so I ended up actually reporting to all the supposed channels, and that was the IG office, which is part of the Department of Justice, and the Congress itself, and tried to take it to the court, but then I was silenced, was, and I'm sure, Shahid, you are familiar with the FISA and FISA rules, right? Because part of my work was basically translating when it was necessary, because sometimes the communications were all in English. These were the wiretaps, the surveillance on diplomatic communities here from all these different countries, and the foreign organizations, foreign lobby organizations, foreign businesses. So when we listened and got these pieces of information, communications, a lot of these were actually in English. So we obtained a lot of information based on communication between various congressional representatives, you know, the senators, congressmen, their chief of staff, and let's say various foreign lobby organizations. And we had tons of material on how actually they were colluding together to funnel money to a particular congressman or a congresswoman or a senator. Now, by law, based on the law, FBI and DOJ are supposed to shred and get rid of all these secondary information, because while they were seeking to obtain information from the communications of these foreigners that we were targeting, well, we were automatically getting information on our own American citizen representatives. But FBI never did. In fact, FBI compiled these thick files and on all these congressmen and senators. And the question always was, and even the agents wondered, because all these files were being transferred to a certain department in the Justice Department, what do they do with these files? Then you have so much information that you can put, I would say, at any given moment, and this is only for several languages that I translated, okay? I mean, if you put all the department, 250 language specialists who were speaking Chinese and Arabic, they had their own set of information that they were obtaining and they were putting in these files for the FBI that involved other congressmen and congresswomen and senators. So what did the FBI and DOJ do with this information? Because they could put, and they had enough to put if they wanted to use, or open a criminal investigation based on what they obtained illegally under FISA to pursue these people. So they don't put them in jail. They don't pursue them criminally. How do they use this information? Most likely blackmail. And that was the belief shared by many FBI agents I work with. They said, probably, you know, when those hearings happen, you know, when they bring in the director to supposedly grill them, The director can say, by the way, you know, chairman of this committee, you're aware and we are aware of some of, you know, they can just go ahead and name a couple of those lobby organizations. And that would be more than enough to shut them up. And this is the Congress to shut them up. People think, okay, those were the J. Edgar Hoover days, and those days have been over. But one of the things that I found out, and one of the things that is a common knowledge among the FBI counterintelligence agents, is the fact that FBI and the Justice Department had tons of files in all our representatives. So my question, now I'm going to turn around and ask the question, to Shahid, is when this is the case, isn't that just ludicrous and futile for us? And I have an organization, and I used to do the same thing, to collect all these petitions and try to go and pressure and try to move Congress to do something about the FBI. When that particular body is so corrupt and they are so much under influence, and on top of it, they are in this position of being blackmailed by the Justice Department and the FBI. I mean, for example, we saw what happened in Jane Harmon's case. They obtained through wiretap that she was leaking information and she was actually trying to get some people off the hook. And then he was on the phone with she was on the phone with the Israel lobby, and that case went away. They had enough to criminally pursue Jane Harmon. They dropped. Well, of course, Jane Harmon is in this position to do lots of favor in return. So when this is the case, Shahid, why do we spend so much time and energy, and I used to do that, I did it for years, trying to do all this petition and go to Congress and say, Congress, do something. You know, it's like you're in a neighborhood and you get together, unite against some sort of a mob, and then you start sending letters and asking the mob to help you go after a mob.
No, it's a great comparison. And for what it's worth, I don't think petitions to Congress really do much good. And that's right. One reason we don't do a lot of that. I think there's a need to build a movement. And movements can do a lot. If you look at the Church Committee, and granted, it left a lot of work undone, and the Church and the Pike Committees were hardly ideal representations of what we'd want to see. But in the context of a grassroots movement, it became very hard for those agencies to escape scrutiny. And it was very long coming, and it was very still inadequate. But I think as we look to the landscape that surrounds us today, the only option that we do have, I think, is to build a movement to really shift the landscape that confronts not only members of Congress, but also courts, which today are very deferential toward the executive branch institutionally. And one hopes people within the FBI and the law enforcement agencies themselves. I mean, the fact of the Bureau compiling political dossiers on members of Congress is certainly disturbing. And as we're talking about it, you know, the only saving grace I have is that the Bureau is offensive in so many different directions at once. You know, I get very, for instance, concerned about NGI, the Next Generation Initiative, creating a national ID using biometrics on the backs of what presents itself publicly as an immigrant deportation program that is actually much more than merely that. You know, that terrifies me. The Carnivore database terrifies me. The use of informants and infiltration, all of these different kinds of abuses, I think, add to an edifice. And the whole is worse than the sum of its parts. So the Bureau is essentially a opaque, unaccountable agency that is, you know, it's an institutional recidivist. It finds itself repeatedly enmeshed in these sorts of political quagmires, and I think that it's a real problem with domestic intelligence inherently. I think it's a really philosophically untenable position for the government to take in terms of surveilling and monitoring its own population. I don't know if there's a way to do it consistent with the ideals that our Constitution stands for, and I think you're right that merely petitioning Congress is not enough. I do think raising awareness and giving grassroots Americans who are concerned from any walk of life things that we can actually do to raise that awareness and build a movement to hold these agencies accountable, I think that's absolutely critical and crucial. And I'm glad to see it happening, even if only in microcosm and even if only for now it fits and starts.
But we have been doing it for now consistently for 10 years, you know, you and the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights and the EFF, and you know, we've been really nonstop doing it. It's just raising the awareness, and even to a certain degree when it gets to the media, let's say the NSA's illegal eavesdropping. Finally, after being held, it was published by the New York Times. And yes, it did become front page, and everybody became aware. Every American knows that we are being spied upon, we are under surveillance. So the awareness is there, but there is no course of action. That's the thing with these movements and with raising awareness. For 10 years, things have been getting worse. Nothing has gotten better. We are in much worse position today than we were 8 years ago. So if that's the case, what are we doing wrong?
Great question. I think that one of the things we're doing wrong, and I certainly don't mean to point fingers at different institutions here, but I think that we, as a movement concerned with executive accountability, a vastly disproportionate share, and I do mean on the order of 90-something percent, of the resources in the social change arena have gone to litigation, to courts. And the unfortunate reality is courts will not check the executive branch today, whether that's due to the political background, whether that's due to the preponderance of prosecutors on the federal bench, whether that's due to the, maybe the FBI's blackmailing judges, too. I have no idea. But the fact of the matter is that the courts have very rarely seen fit to check or balance the executive in our lifetime, and especially in anything relating to the war on terror. I think that there's not been enough raising awareness, quite frankly. I mean, I could point, I think, on one hand to the number of coordinated national campaigns that are actually grassroots in this arena. And I think the need, and this is what is always true in any social movement, the need is to engage everyday individuals, right, to get students and carpenters and beauticians and folks who work at diners and, whomever, and everyone who is not professionally focused on this set of issues involved. And that, quite frankly, has never happened over the last 10 years. I mean, there are glimmers and different examples where it started to happen to a greater or lesser extent. And I think one of the real bright spots there was the work that my predecessors at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee did when organizing municipal resolutions opposing the Patriot Act, which got people in front of their city councils and in front of their school boards. And it was a local action opportunity that gave people a way to actually get involved. And I think so much of this problem, you cited the NSA, and I think it's a perfect example. When the NSA's warrantless wiretapping was revealed in 2005, it landed on the front page of every major news outlet, but there wasn't so much of a movement in place to respond to it. There were certainly attempts. I could think about online attempts like Get FISA Right. In the summer of 2008, it was the largest group on MyBarackObama.com, and they were telling the president, reject the bill that would authorize this clearly unconstitutional and un-American dragnet spying program. And to his discredit, the president, after promising to filibuster the bill, ended up not only not filibustering it, but then voted for it. And as a president has, as far as we know, kept it in place and used it. And I think that demonstrates the inability to rely on our mechanisms of government. The institutions have all failed, right? Courts have failed to see through the state secrets privilege and hold accountable executive abuses. Congress has failed to exercise any meaningful oversight or to resist statutory extensions of powers that we know have already been abused. Internal watchdog organizations within the executive branch, like the inspector generals, have failed to identify the full range of abuses and have failed to offer recommendations that would address all of them. And they failed to secure those recommendations, reflections, and policy. All that is to say, the check or balance that remains to be flexed, and this is the one that I don't think over the last 10 years has ever made itself felt, and that's we, the people of the United States. And I see in movements as diverse as the Tea Party to the Occupy movement a broad, diverse, shared understanding about government lawlessness. And I do hope that from that understanding can emerge a shared consensus around what to do about it. At the very least, I think it entails raising awareness. But you're right, awareness cannot be all. And I think that beyond awareness, there's a need for action. And I think that opportunities to politicize these kinds of abuses in whatever arenas we can, whether that's our labor union committees, whether that's our student governments, whether that's our city councils or our state legislatures. Those are important steps to take, because not only will those steps raise awareness, but we can chip away at the federal edifice by creating protections at lower jurisdictional units. There are a lot of things that city councils and state legislatures can do to address domestic spying by the agents who do it, because it's not just the FBI. Increasingly, it's the Mayberry Police Department, which might be cooperating with the FBI through a joint terrorism task force or a fusion center or any other number of mechanisms. And I think the chance for people to take action where we do have influence is what is particularly critical, and I think that's much of what's been missing over the last 10 years as courts and litigation strategies have given, maybe some people a false sense of security.
Well, Shahid, I appreciate that you are a buoyant individual and you have a positive and I think hopeful attitude toward this, but let me throw a little cold water on it. We know that from the FBI, the Justice Inspector General, that when they've examined the abuses of the national security letters, in some cases it's fully 50% of those national security letters. And if just to recap how those are used, when one receives a national security letter, you are forbidden to talk about it. You are gagged. You are told that it's against the law for you to share this with anybody else. Likewise, when they go to your library and use a national security letter to see what books or videos you've taken out, the librarian is not allowed to tell the targeted individual that they are being surveilled. And when we pile all this up, I mean, that's just one microcosm of it. But the unaccountable power of the FBI, the failure of Congress, as you pointed out, to exercise its appropriate oversight roles, really leaves the average citizen as just a target. And most people don't want to fight this because they think that if they become too visible, that they might wind up at Guantanamo. And that's not so far-fetched with the passage of the language attached to the National Defense Authorization Act. So my point of view is that we are seeing a real tightening of a kind of crackdown and crunch on people who speak up and speak out. And while there is freedom of speech, and I haven't been arrested for the comments I make on broadcast radio or on this podcast, we all end up looking over our shoulders wondering if we're going to be next, if we're going to be like the people in Chicago and Milwaukee whose homes were raided pre-dawn in September of 2010. And these people have not been charged, but they were brushed back by the authorities in ways that will make them think twice about their work in advocating for peace with various groups from Colombia to Afghanistan. So that's a long-winded approach here, but my comment is summed up that we have a growing police state, and our elected officials aren't doing anything to stop it or to make it constitutional. The courts have limited control, and we have an administration headed by Barack Obama that is fully expanding the executive authority that was first grabbed under Bush. So I see these as very dire developments, and while I'm glad that people have gone to local government and gotten resolutions against the Patriot Act, there were a lot of resolutions calling for the impeachment of Bush, there's no real tangible effect to show for it.
I'd push back a little bit there, and I do agree with you that the situation is dire. There's no question. The democracy in America, I dare say, hangs by a thread at this point. And to bite off a piece of that hypo, like think about the those activists in Chicago and Minneapolis, as well as L.A., who've been raided by the FBI for nonviolent speech crimes. They've never been charged, but under the NDAA and the new detention provisions that just became law, those people don't have merely to fear future investigations. People in a similar position could simply be detained militarily without trial. I mean, it is dramatically worse now than it was even, Sybil made the point about 8 years ago, it's worse now than it was 2 weeks ago. And I do fear that, we are falling off a constitutional cliff. So I certainly share your sense of concern and your prognosis that it is really bad. And perhaps I'm simply the person with a hammer looking at the nail, here, but I do think that it is too early to throw in the towel. And on the relevance of local action, I would push back in particular. So with respect to executive accountability, say, in the impeachment context, whether for lying about wars or authorizing human rights abuses in the context of torture and waterboarding, or for that matter, creating a detention regime or a surveillance regime that are patently lawless and un-American, inspired by, you know, communist China or the Soviet Union, as far as I can tell, all of these different abuses certainly would have, generated a stronger political response had there been a wider groundswell of those kinds of resolutions. You know, impeachment resolutions actually were not very far and wide. One thing we could say about the Patriot Act, and this is very limited in time, but during the era when the resolutions were passing very frequently, there were critical limits placed on Patriot Act powers. In 2005, this was the first time the bill was reauthorized, there were a series of sunsets put in place which would not have been there had there not been questions raised by numbers, you know, a great many members of Congress whose districts included towns that had passed these resolutions. So I do think it offers another way to crack the nut of a D.C. cabal, instead of institutions that have failed to actively check and balance one another and have increasingly grown aligned. You know, our framers of our Constitution spoke, for all of their many faults, spoke very explicitly about the need for courts to be independent and the critical value of independent courts in enabling checks and balances. And Congress, you know, separately from the courts, was Article 1 in the Constitution for a reason. Both of those branches have grown subservient to the executive branch. And in the figure of President Obama, I think we have a very compelling indication of why we can't rely on D.C. institutions to check themselves. You know, he ran on a platform that was, in no uncertain terms, he said that the choice between liberty and security was a false one, that he was going to restore the constitutional principles that the Bush administration has eroded, and all that's happened since he came in was a doubling down and an expansion of those abuses. You know, the NDAA creates a set of government authorities that Cheney never dreamed of when he was in office. I do think that it's gotten a lot worse, but I think that the historical extent to which we the people have raised our voices pales in comparison to what we need to do. I mean, granted, 400 towns passed anti-patriot resolutions, but there are tens of thousands of cities in the United States. And we should all be raising our voices. I think the relative passivity with which we the people of the United States are actively resigning our rights, or let me rephrase that, the relative passivity with which we are casually resigning our rights and ignoring the kinds of news cycles that Sybil was talking about. When the NSA does land on the front page of the paper, and some people read it, but very few take action. And on the NDAA, which is an earthquake, very few people even know it was happening. And I think the secrecy and the transparency prevents the kind of political mobilization that we need to see. And I agree with you that what is happening around the country, even in the bright spots, while very inspiring, is not nearly enough by a long shot. But I do think that the only way out is to raise our voices and to build a movement. And if only because, quite frankly, I don't have another answer, that's the only one I can see getting us out of here. So I'll certainly go down swinging, and I know that Peter will certainly be at the microphone when the hammer falls. So I imagine you will be, too. So,
well, you know, Shahid, maybe we can share an ocean view suite at Guantanamo, but I do feel deeply frustrated, and the sense that the fix is in virtually every direction. And let me add a new layer here. Last week, very little coverage, the State Department announced the creation of the Bureau of Counterterrorism, which will coordinate with United States entities such as the Department of Homeland Security and foreign governments to develop civilian counterterrorism strategies and operations. Now, here we go with a new layer of bureaucracy, and I sound like a Republican when I use that phrase, but I can't imagine that we need any other offices or bureaus to take away our constitutional rights. There are plenty of laws on the books to deal with criminals of every stripe, including terrorists who want to hurt American citizens. But to create all of these new systems And this is, you know, another repudiation of the Obama campaign message. And we're seeing these things erected as the average person has either checked out or is ducking because they simply live in fear that these kinds of apparatuses will be used against them.
I fully agree with you, and I think it's interesting. I'll take a similar line and sound like a Republican here. The reason the gap in the analysis might be our presumption that the creation of the new State Department agency actually aims to fix a legitimate problem. I think increasingly in the counterterrorism and national security arena, the reason to create new offices and new departments and to award new contracts to new subcontractors is not to deal with a legitimate threat, but it's rather to put money in the essentially structurally corrupt entities' pockets that comprise this complex. And I don't know very much about the background underlying the State Department office. I would say mm-hmm. that the State Department has a fraction of the resources of the Defense Department, and to the extent this gives state an opportunity to claw back from defense some of the resources that might otherwise, for instance, go to the CIA, I'm all for it. Whether or not that will happen, or whether it will simply become another line item on the inflated federal budget and the grossly disproportionate share of it that goes to national security, well, you know, that would obviously be a hole in the bucket, and I don't know where that's going to end up. But yeah, it is certainly unnecessary, and I would commend on this matter, this particular point about secrecy and bloat and waste, Dana Priest and William Arkin's excellent book, mm-hmm. Top Secret America, and I think that there is a huge hole in the bucket of our federal budget, and all of the conversation this year about the budget crisis, I think, has been really misinformed, because the simple fact of the matter is if we just cut out the constitutionally invasive programs, even if we left everything else in place, we'd be fine. But the NSA monitoring everyone's phone calls and emails, that's really expensive. And the FBI having to sift through all this information about people that it's vacuuming up through national security letters, which are often unbounded from any legitimate purpose, that's really expensive. And to house detainees at Guantanamo at the cost of $800,000 per person per year, that adds up. And I think that, you know, we're spending $2 billion a month on air conditioning alone in Iraq, or we were at least until the drawdown recently. You know, these costs are a lot more impactful on our federal budget than the public sector employees unions that some factions of our polity like to make a big show of going after. And I do think that there's a huge problem with pork barrel spending here. And unfortunately, the foxes are guarding the hen house, and the members of Congress, who we would hope, again, going back to Sybil's point before, would check it and balance these runaway agencies. You know, they're up to their necks in it. And you think about the revolving door from Congress to K Street, the general counsel of the FBI, whom, you know, I spent a good deal of my career chasing around trying to fix her mistakes. Valerie Caproni is now an assistant general counsel. I believe it's Lockheed Martin. It might be Northrop Grumman. I can't tell if the defense contractors apart. But that's a perfect example of people, you know, playing in the system. And I'm sure she's making seven or eight figures a year now. And I think that it's really, quite frankly, appalling. And I think that that's a game that unfortunately has become really well played in Washington. And most of the participants in the institutional scheme in one way or another are bought in or complicit.
Now, Shahid, coming back to this recently signed, it was on New Year's Eve, the National Defense Authorization Act, there are a number of egregious provisions in there. And we have talked about this on other programs, so I won't dwell on the facets that permit an American citizen to be detained indefinitely without charge or trial. But I would like you to comment on the way that the Congress is trying to, in this case, limit the role of the FBI and domestic courts in dealing with terrorists, at least those who are captured in the United States. And the way that, and it is bipartisan, but it appears to originate with Republicans, they are determined to keep Guantanamo open by defining that terrorism suspects must be detained by the military and then tried before the kangaroo courts called military tribunals. What is your analysis of why the Congress wants to trust the military with these matters more than the civilian agencies, including the FBI.
I think it's really the reason Congress wants to put the military in the place of our Article III courts is because it's less reviewable. You know, what happens in military custody is essentially hidden, and it is unaccountable, and there doesn't need to be any modicum of legitimacy to the proceedings, whereas even though our Article III courts are also themselves pretty co-opted, there is at least some pretense of independence that the military courts don't have. And so I think a large part of the push from the right wing, and I do want to make the point here, though, you know, Democrats were certainly complicit and in no way, shape, or form any better than the Republicans on the Defense Authorization Act. And one of the things that's particularly interesting to me about that reform is that it passed, even though the Secretary of Defense, the FBI Director, the Director of National Intelligence, the President, the Chief of the Intelligence Committee, and the Judiciary Committee all said, this is an insane idea. What are you people thinking? You know, they still went ahead. And it's interesting to note, you know, who was speaking in the Republican lunch on the Senate side the day that the NDAA was voted on? It was Dick Cheney. And I think this takes us back to part of the conversation we had before. The continuity from the Bush administration into the Obama administration really set the stage for this abuse, because not only was torture, for instance, never repudiated through any accountability for the senior architects, but the same people who constructed the torture regime before are still active on Capitol Hill, and they're responsible largely for this latest constitutional travesty that just landed in our lap in the form of indefinite military detention for U.S. citizens. The particular part, two pieces here I just stressed. One is the First Amendment implication under the Patriot Act material support provisions, as upheld in the Humanitarian Law Project case. People are essentially at risk of being declared terrorists for their beliefs. That's kind of what's happening to the Peace and Justice activists in Chicago, LA, and Minneapolis. That's what happens to a lot of environmentalists who might commit environmentally motivated vandalism. You know, these are not crimes of terror by any stretch, but that's long been what we treat them as. And because we're now denying, and this gets back to the answer to your question, Peter, the reason I think the right wing is pushing for military resolution of terror-related offenses is because it will make it much easier in the dystopian future to silence political opposition when speech is terror, and terror means, you know, no trial, indefinite detention, lock someone up and throw away the key. It certainly creates a stronger potential for social control with those powers to be vested in the military. And I do think that even to whatever extent someone might not understand the civil liberties implications of these sorts of very meaningful and terrifying reforms, the national security implications should give us pause, because quite frankly, the military doesn't know how to do this. It's not a domestic detention agency. The Pentagon doesn't want to do it. The FBI, I hate to say this, actually has some modicum of expertise here, even if it tends to abuse it whenever it has the chance. But, you know, I certainly would prefer the FBI having a domestic intelligence role to the military playing those functions. I don't know if anyone's seen here among the three of us the movie The Siege, starring Denzel Washington and Bruce Willis from the late 90s, but it is quite stark and indicates to me, you know, some of the difference. As problematic as the FBI is, the military, in terms of the civil liberties implications of domestic deployment, which has now been authorized in violation of the Posse Comitatus Act, is very unsettling, to say the least. And I think these are questions that we should all be paying attention to. And I do hope, to get back to our prior conversation, that people take action on these understandings and raise our voices, not just to each other and to our friends and our family, but also to our elected officials and our neighbors and our coworkers, and spread the awareness of these issues beyond the small number and the small proportion of America that cares enough about our rights to be vocal, or even for that matter, to pay attention.
I have a couple of comments on this. One is when we are talking about ordinary Americans, because my impression, and this is based on talking with so many ordinary Americans, and where I live, they are affluent, they are above, you know, upper middle class, educated, and when I talk with these people, when I provide them with some of these new legislations and the implications, the look they give me is this: you know, I'm so busy. I mean, here I'm trying to juggle my work, and I'm commuting 2 hours a day, and I have to pick up my kids from the daycare and bring them home. I really don't have time for these activism business. Number two, they say they truly see, and this is, I believe, where 90% of the Americans are today, they see themselves exempt. They're like, look, those things are for some suspicious, they're terrorists, and look, I'm not doing anything wrong. If I'm not saying anything wrong, why should I be bothered by NSA listening, you know, and monitoring me? If I'm not talking about terrorism, why should I bother about FBI reading all my emails? I'm not doing anything wrong. And then when I mentioned people that, you know, the example Peter provided, you know, on September 10th and the activists, the protesters in Minneapolis, well, they kind of shrug and say, well, you know, that's collateral damage. And even so much, you know, so much more reason not to sign petitions and get involved with people like that, because that's going to get us in trouble. So the general attitude when you do provide them with this information is, I have my kids to worry about. I have my 401k to worry about. I have my credit card debt. I'm commuting. I don't have time for this. And even, you know, I have more reason to stay away from even people like you, because you know what, Sabelle? Associating with you may get me in trouble. Well, that raising awareness is doing that to them. And with the very small segments when they say, yes, let's do something, what do you suggest, you know, doing? Well, if I point to Congress and say, go pressure your representatives, in a way, I'm becoming culprit there, Shahid, because it's like, again, I keep giving analogies here, and I'm going to ask for you to give us some rhymes. That way it will neutralize my analogies. You go to a dentist, and the dentist says, oh, my God, your entire root for this particular tooth is rotten. We need to pull it out, right? And then you say, oh, no, I'm going to go and take Advil, and I'm going to take antibiotics, and I'm going to put some ice pack and keep on it. Well, you are not really treating and getting rid of this infected tooth, which is the only option you have. So when you're looking at these institutions, I mean, for example, the Congress, it's in a way legitimizing these people who are willingly going and passing this law on NDAA by saying, go to these corrupt, to these same people who actually are the cause. These are the causes and the sources of our problems today. They are not the solution. They are the cause. Where do you think, when they say government is doing this, government is not a person. Government is this, the courts and the Congress and all these agencies, executive agencies, including Pentagon and FBI and NSA. So these are the reasons. Like today, I believe Thomas Jefferson would be detained under NDAA, because Thomas Jefferson said we do need revolutions every now and then. We need to get rid of it and start from scratch, because if you have the foundation rotten, it's really, really rotten, and by that I mean the entire Congress, you can't try to go and build houses and doors and put some roof over top of something there on a foundation that is rotten, is going to collapse. So this is why in 2008 we stopped NSW, you know, this is NSWBC, National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, said what you need to do is change that institution. We need to get rid of it and replace it with real representatives, because we don't have real representatives. So by saying, going, okay, this is the awareness, what do you do with it? Go and get Congress to act on it. The only positive thing that I have read in the past few months has been the development in Montana.
Of the recall of the senators who voted for the NDAA. Right.
Absolutely. Now, to me, that's an actionable item. This is going down and getting local with it. And in fact, some of the more libertarian-leaning people have had, you know, these ideas and suggestions on, you know, nullification, saying, well, to a certain degree, it's the responsibility of the states to take a stand and say, you know what, we don't want to participate in this. If it's economics, no, we don't. If it's all the stuff with the surveillance, and they do have the power, and they can. But to look at the federal courts and our Congress here in Washington and to say we're going to go pressure them, I think that is actually legitimizing an illegitimate institution, an institution that has lost all its legitimacy.
So at best, and at worst, it might even just be a waste of time, right? I mean, if the members of Congress had bought into the infrastructure that they've developed, and I guess I harbor some hope that a lot of them, quite frankly, are not bought in. They're just clueless. If you talk to members of Congress about the NDAA, for instance, most of them don't even realize what they voted for. They're too unsophisticated to even read the bill in the context of the rest of the laws that exist. You know, there's a caveat in one of the sections that a lot of people thought meant something that Senator Feinstein had introduced, saying nothing in this law will be read to change the existing law or authorities with respect to detaining citizens, except we already have, and most members of Congress didn't realize this, I think, that regime for U.S. citizens is well established. It's just to this point only happened to a few people. So they're, you know, they're unwitting participants in a process that is architected by, I think, a small number among them. And I agree that there are, you know, the foundation is rotten, and I won't defend it. I just think that there are certainly a lot of opportunities to engage it in the process of changing it. And I think that one way to get Congress completely replaced, for instance, might be to raise awareness about the stupidity of the decisions that our Congress has made. And I think that there are a lot of things that, for instance, some groups may be in a better position to do than others. The ACLU can litigate in court. We can't do that. And I think, you know, the Occupy movements can mobilize around the country. We can't do that. We can help arm information activists with information about local opportunities to politicize these challenges, whereas another group may not be in a position to do that. And another group might be in a position to impact elections, which we can't, right? So there are a lot of different roles to play in the movement. And I think it's important to remember that we have to address these kinds of abuses as social movements, right? I mean, if we think about history, looking back in the day during World War One, it was the FBI versus free speech that held the gun, right? Hard-fought constitutional rights on the run, the Palmer Raids the first, but not the only one. Fast forward 40 years to the real Red Scare. McCarthy did a number, but the FBI was there. They were everywhere. They knew what you wore to bed. They prosecuted people for the thoughts in our heads. They tried to drive MLK to suicide. No one even knows the whole story about how Brother Malcolm died. Fred Hampton killed in his own house, inside. They even bombed Earth activist Judy Barry's car and lied. And those lies went all the way up the chain of command. The FBI routinely lies to judges when on the stand. The director, the head honcho, the man claims his lies were unplanned and that he didn't understand that it's the FBI versus the Constitution. We the people are the ones the bureau's been abusing. Inside activist groups and churches, they be cruising on civil rights and national security confusion, raiding the homes of peaceful activists, setting in motion predictable plot twists, arresting democracy to bind her wrists. This miseducation of a gullible nation shows the ruination of our country's creation. You can say, be patient, but the Bill of Rights hastens to fall to pieces before our very eyes. Do everything you're told so you realize our rights got sold. Beware the 05. Into any group goes the FBI's eyes. Intelligence about legal behavior, the prize. Panopticon, Stasi, informants every size, shape, and color. You're being watched by Big Brother right now. Every email, every call. Before national security, the Constitution falls. The FBI's probably got informants walking these halls. It's the FBI versus the Constitution. We the people are the ones the bureau's been abusing. Inside activist groups and churches, they be cruising on civil rights and national security confusion. Demands for private information misused. Gagging the recipients of First Amendment views attached to the Patriot Act national ruse. First, we lose the privacy that enables speech. Then we let our government expand its reach into our bank accounts, medical records, teachers' feedback, your ISP, browsing history, mental seed bank, or library down the street, if it's still open. The Bureau threatens democracy. I'm not joking. Our rights are in the scope. We are all on the rope. Poke at three letters. NGI. It's the next generation for the FBI. Facilitating mass deportations by ICE while we citizens pay an equal price. Less demand for housing, less tax revenue, crops rotting on the vine. What else do we do? We'll take the local cops arrest data and give it to the feds. But take a look at what the FBI itself said. If we start with immigrants, it'll give the plan cred. That led beyond mass deportation. Instead, the Bureau has a price, a file on your head, your fingerprints, your iris patterns, your voice. A national ID imposed without choice. There is blood on our Constitution, but it's still moist. It's the FBI versus we, the people. Don't stoop, don't grovel to no government steeple. We can force any agency to make a new choice if we build a movement and we each raise our voice. I'll say that again. We can force any agency to make a new choice if we build a movement and we each raise our voice.
Shahid Buttar.
Bravo. Now you have one more fan in your fan club.
Very kind.
And in addition to his work at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Shahid is a very talented artist. And you still have a website at shahidbhutar.com?
I do. Yes, indeed.
So people can find out more about your other and inner life. Shahid, in the rich rhyming delivery that you just gave us, one of the references was to the insertion of paid informants, provocateurs. And we have more than 19 documented cases now of prosecutions that involved a paid informant working for the FBI. And in each case, these were people who were sideways with the law, so they were very easy to manipulate. They were, in most cases, paid cash by the FBI to infiltrate groups. And in the cases that have been documented, they often created the context for the crimes that were contemplated by these individuals. And it's really a huge miscarriage of justice. It's entrapment. It is a phony form of law enforcement that misleads people that the government is actually protecting us from people who want to do us harm. And this is another page out of the playbook of J. Edgar Hoover. And I cut my teeth in the 1970s in Chicago trying to get to the truth of the murder of Fred Hampton, the Black Panther leader. And it was such a sordid case. And when you saw the documents signed off by J. Edgar Hoover himself, giving the local FBI, in concert with the Chicago police, permission to conduct a raid where they knew they would murder Fred Hampton. Well, we're doing that again. And this again leads back to Robert Mueller, the FBI director who he took office just, a week before 9/11. And he has presided over these intentional corruptions of our criminal justice system and these phony convictions that have been won. And there's no accountability for it. And he was rewarded, as we've said, with a 2-year extension of his term. And I'd like to know if you see any remedies for these KGB tactics that we thought we had stopped after Hoover left office and the reforms after Watergate. And yet they are right back in front of us again.
I'd like to see these become election issues, right? For people, when they're making their decisions about who to vote for Congress or for the presidency, to take into account the kinds of votes that people have cast on these kinds of issues. And if people are representatives are going to cast votes to create police state powers in our domestic law enforcement and intelligence agencies, I think those should be reasons for grassroots resistance or grassroots mobilization or grassroots fielding of alternative candidates. There are a lot of people out there who I think would serve very capably and very conscientiously and would not be in bed with the intelligence industrial complex that has risen to seize D.C., and I think that that's another reason that raising awareness and building a movement matters, is because that's how issues become the salient objects of conversation. I mean, we've talked a lot over the last year and heard a lot about a budget conversation. The fact that the budget was in the national conversation reflects the success of some elements in our society in organizing, and they happened to organize very well, and they created a momentum behind a conversation that they wanted to have. And I think that there's another conversation that many different kinds of Americans want to have, everyone from libertarian supporters of Ron Paul to progressive, say, in the peace and justice movement, disappointed in the president for not being a better paying greater heed to his own rhetoric in the campaign back in 08. I think that the diversity of the voices that care about these issues indicates the strength that we could have together if we do find a way to raise our voice. I don't think that our political system gives us enough opportunities to do it, which is why it's so crucial to come up with them on our own. I would say to people who are concerned about these issues to plug into your local Occupy site or your local Tea Party chapter, if you prefer, but get outside the institutional establishment and find some allies where you live. And talk about projects to raise your voice. That can look like standing on a street corner with a bunch of folks singing songs on a Saturday, to walking down at the office of your member of Congress the next time that they return home to the district to protest their authorization of indefinite military detention without trial. That can look like running for office yourself. There are a million different ways to build a movement, and I think that the key is for us to each apply our individual creativity and scan our networks and see where we can be helpful and how we can apply our skills to helping build the movement, and where the movement can offer us each new skills and opportunities and networks. I think it can be a labor of love, and I think it's one that we all need to engage. I would just really briefly say one piece to an issue that Sybil raised. I think it was the second among the reasons why people stay apathetic when confronted with the information about what's happening. You'd made the point that people sometimes say, well, I have nothing to hide. I really like that one, because that's the easiest one in some respects to respond to, because I think it just reflects a lack of information. People forget why privacy matters. Privacy doesn't matter so you can be comfortable. That's the private dimension of privacy. Privacy matters so you can speak your mind. That's the public dimension of privacy. Even if you have nothing to hide, the fact that you have nowhere to hide means that if you have an unpopular view, you won't express it. And that's a collective harm, because it's not just the person who no longer speaks who's harmed. All of us are harmed, because then we're making decisions based on an artificial slice of the full range of perspectives. The reason the First Amendment exists is so that we can hear the speech of the unpopular voice, because sometimes those folks are onto something. And if we lose the unpopular voice because people are afraid to speak their minds, then we all lose out. And that's why it matters to raise your voice about these issues, even if you, whoever are listening, don't care about the issues, even if you don't feel fear, even if you have nothing to hide. The question is, do you want your kids to grow up in a free society or not? And if you do, you have to take action on these principles, because it will be very hard for anyone to take action on these principles once, as Peter said, you know, we're sharing a seaside room at Guantanamo Bay, if we're lucky, right? I mean, the problem with the NDAA is now they can just detain us here, so they're probably going to lock us up in North Dakota where it's cold.
Yeah.
Excellent point.
Well, Shahid, it's great to talk with you. Thank you for fighting for our rights and the Bill of Rights in particular. Again, the website for your organization, bordc.org, Bill of Rights Defense Committee.org, and ShahidButar.com. If you'd like to check out some of his artistic expression. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me on, Peter. Thank you, Sybil. Keep speaking the truth, y'all.
Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.